Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Lech Lecha. This is week number 2 in our new cycle. The new cycle is basics. Last week, the purpose of our class was to define the basics of what? The answer was, it's the basics, and this is what I said last week, it's the basics of Jewish spirituality. Not the basics of mitzvah observance, per se, not the basics of faith, per se, but the basics of Jewish spirituality. I want to modify that title a bit, because when you say the term Jewish spirituality, it connotes it is an aspect of life. And that's really a misrepresentation. Similar to the, I don't know if you've ever heard somebody say that Judaism is not a religion, because religion also implies that it's an aspect of life. Okay? There's life. There's my career. There's my family. There's my recreation. There's my religion. It's like a compartment that has a place in life, but it is not life itself. And I think that all of us who've been studying together realize that Judaism is much more than a compartment. It is the definition of life according to God's Torah. It is life itself.
When you say Judaism is not a religion, you mean it's a religion and then some.
But I would, it's not even, you can't even say, and that's just like saying it's a big religion or it's a religion with icing. It's really not a religion. It is the meaning of life according to God's Torah. So let's just modify that, because I don't want to go throughout the year and say this is a class on the basics of Jewish spirituality if that's really kind of the wrong connotation. Let's say that this is the basics of Torah reality. Because that's really, when we're studying Torah, we're studying a new definition of reality. It takes the assumptions that we have as modern men, Western men, and ladies, secular, whatever, and it turns these assumptions into a new reality. So that's really what we're trying to do. And I'm not trying to be petty with the language. We're studying the basics of what is the Torah reality. Okay, last week we learned that at the core of the basics of this Torah reality is that there are two main characters in this reality. We likened it to a play or to a movie, where there are two main characters, and they have equal billing on the credits, on the credit line. Those two characters are God and man. And that may be an assumption that is not shared by modern people. They may not even have God on the credit line. They may not have God in the movie at all. If they do, they may have God as sort of like this all-consuming presence, such that we can't even deal with it, or it totally overshadows man, and man is just a nothing. That's not the perspective of the Torah reality. The perspective of the Torah reality is that there are two, if you will, partners in life. There's God and there's man. We also established that the identity of neither of those characters are readily clear. We certainly have a hard time conceiving of God. And in truth, we have a hard time of conceiving of man. We really are at a loss to know truly who we are. You know, we're much more than just that image that we see when we look in the mirror. We are a body, we are a soul, we are an emotions, we are an intellect. So we kind of spent last week just introducing these two main characters and giving a little bit of basics about each of them. But of course, we need to expand. So So today's class, class number two, is going to give the impression that we are going to focus on the character God, Hashem, the Supreme Being, but it's going to have a surprise ending. I'll leave it at that, just to whet your appetite. The reason why we see this topic, besides being kind of the next step in the basics, the reason why it's appropriate for Parshas Lech Lecha, because Parshas Lech Lecha is the story of Avraham. And Avraham, our sages tell us, discovered God on his own. So, if we want to discover who God is, what better teacher, what better guide, what better model than Avraham, our patriarch. And just to kind of get the real story on Avraham, you know, the Parsha begins with Hashem telling Avraham, go to the land that I will show you, Lech Lecha. But that was already many, many years into Avraham's life. Why did God tell Avraham Lech Lecha? Why did he choose him and not somebody else? Because Avraham had a history. So Maimonides, Rambam, writes for us a wonderful chapter in out of Avraham's biography, if you will, that really precedes this Lech Lecha. And in it, the Rambam describes the climate in the times of Avraham. It was a climate of disbelief, of non-belief, if you will, in God. Now, very important to realize, the non-believers of those days were not like the non-believers of today, atheists. There were no atheists in those days. Everyone was, and we've spoken about this a number of times, everyone was aware of a supreme, of a big, I shouldn't say supreme, of big powers that were causing things to happen in the world. Nobody was an atheist. The question was, is it one or is it many? Is it this invisible, intangible, supreme being, or is it the sun, the moon, etc., or some other deity? That was the struggle. Nobody woke up one morning and say, well, this world is just kind of, nothing's really happening. It's all scientific, it's all nature, it just is. And there's nothing behind it. They weren't like that. So the nature of Avraham's discovery may be different than the nature of our discovery. We're working against different forces, different oppositions. So just we have to keep that in mind when we compare our era. But it doesn't really matter. Essentially, it's the same question. Do we recognize God or not? So the Rambam writes, he really spends a lot of time discussing the development of idolatry. So let me start from kind of the end of that. The wise men among them would think that there is no God other than the stars and spheres, for whose sake and in resemblance of which they had made these images. The eternal rock, which is description of God, was not recognized or known by anyone in the world, with the exception of a few individuals like Hanoch, Mesushelach, Noach, Shem, and Aver. The world continued in this fashion until the pillar of the world, the patriarch Abraham, was born. After this mighty man was weaned, he began to explore and think. Though he was a child, he began to think incessantly throughout the day and night, wondering, how is it possible for the sphere? I guess they knew that the world was round. How was it possible for the sphere to continue to revolve without having anyone controlling it? Who is causing it to revolve? Surely it does not cause itself to revolve. He had no teacher, nor was there anyone to inform him. Rather, he was mired in Ur Kasdim among the foolish idolaters. His father, mother, and all the people around him were idol worshippers, and he would worship with them. However, his heart was exploring and gaining understanding. Ultimately, he appreciated the way of truth and understood the path of righteousness through accurate comprehension. He realized that there was one God who controlled the sphere, that he created everything, that there is no other God among all the other entities. He knew that the entire world was making a mistake. What caused them to err was their service of the stars and images, which made them lose awareness of the truth. Abraham was 40 years old when he became aware of his creator. When he recognized, that's when he wrote his thesis. Before that, he was doing research. When he recognized and knew him, he began to formulate replies to the inhabitants of Ur-Kasdim and debate with them, telling them that they were not following a proper path. He broke their idols and began to teach the people that it is fitting to serve only the God of the world. To him alone it is fitting to bow down, sacrifice, offer libations, so that the people of future generations would recognize him.
For his writings today.
I don't know if he had any.
You just said he did.
What? Writing?
Yeah.
Formulate replies. That could have been oral debates. I don't know if he wrote any books.
Where is it?
There were no publishers. This is Rambam, Maimonides.
And what?
Mishneh Torah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and on and on. That was Avraham. And you may recall that once, a few years ago, not too long ago, I asked the question, it was the class on Parshas Lech Lecha, and I asked the question, why do we still continue to celebrate Avraham? Because, yes, he was an important founder of the Jewish movement, but we don't really need his activities as a source of belief or of truth, because we have the Torah. We have been granted the Torah at Mount Sinai. And so we should really celebrate Moshe and the event of the giving of the Torah. Why do we need to keep on going back and speaking about Avraham, the founder? You know, we're way beyond that. And I gave a class on that. I know there's a good answer, and I gave an answer, and I'd like to maybe offer a new and improved answer. But this is part of the surprise that lies at the end of today's class.
What about the foundation?
In the meantime, we are going to devote our class to discovering God the way Avraham discovered God. Okay? This class is going to focus on the character God, not so much the character of man, or it would seem. So, for our guide in this topic, discovering God, I would like to share with you a chapter in Rabbi Meir Schiller's book, The Road Back, that I've quoted extensively from, but never really this chapter, chapter 3. Chapter 3 is called Why Go Back? And basically, it's devoted to various arguments and proofs that have been made over the years by philosophers and religious men, not only religious men, about why we should believe in God. How many proofs? One or two or three or four? Try over 20. First, a word about proofs of God. Proofs of God, Meir Schiller writes, is not like scientific proofs. They're not like proofs that have formula. And they are, immutable or irrefutable. That's not what we mean. We don't prove God in the scientific sense. There's really no such thing as a proof that God exists that one cannot refute. One could refute any proof of God. Because remember, God created us with free will. If it was irrefutable, there wouldn't be much free will there. So what is a proof of God? Well, one way of looking at it, something that I recently read, one of my daughters in high school was given something to read from Rabbi Pinkus, Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus, who we studied from last year, his book on prayer. But he writes in a different book a very interesting definition of what has been come to be known as simple faith, emuna pshuta. There's this thing called simple faith. A Jew is supposed to have simple faith. So he says, what does simple faith mean? Does simple faith mean you believe without thinking? You just believe? No. You cannot extol anything without thinking. You cannot say that a Jew is supposed to believe without thinking. Rather, what simple faith means is that you can look at an issue and you can give an explanation with lots of good evidence, lots of good support. Let's say, in our case, to prove that there's a God, lots of good information. And then you can come up with another theory, which will say, no, there's no God. X, Y, and Z, this happened and that happened, and it was a big bang, and it was an accident, and all this, and it was evolution. I'm not saying those per se are wrong. I'm just saying you could have one explanation and another explanation. Emuna pshuta, simple faith, means which one is more reasonable? Let's be honest. Which one is more simple? Which one is more convincing? If you have simple faith, then you follow the more straightforward argument. If you don't have simple faith, then you ask very hard-headed, unrealistic, skeptical questions. Well, maybe this or that or the other. That is the antithesis of simple faith. So that's what it means when we prove God. We don't prove God. What we do is we offer a lot of good evidence, a lot of good reasons, convincing arguments, things that people, that satisfy people's intelligence and people's reason. And you can then, if you want, say, I'm not convinced. You can, but you're denying simple faith. Okay, does that make sense here? When we say a proof, some people expect that a proof means, well, if it's a proof, then I could not refute it. And since I can refute it, it's not a good proof. So therefore, it's invalid. Because people are thinking of proof like in a scientific sense, and that's not what a proof of God is. I just want to make that kind of opening statement Meir Schiller does. That's what we're learning. We're learning some good facts, some good arguments, some good reasoning that's convincing to the person who has a simple meaning, an uncomplicated and not far-fetched mind. All right, the other point to mention in the discussion of faith in God is that Judaism believes that we are predestined, no?
Pre-programmed,
something less than pre-programmed. We are pre-conditioned. There's a word, it's escaping me.
Predisposed,
something like that. We are predisposed for belief in God. God created us with the ability to believe in Him. He commanded us to believe in Him, therefore we must have it within us to do so. If it was impossible to gain it, how could He command us to do it? So let's just remember that if we argue with it, we're really arguing against our own intrinsic ability to believe. That's another point about emuna in Hashem. And finally, it is, after all, an obligation. It is an obligation. Just as God will judge us at the end of days, you know, did you, you know, help the poor? Did you carry out justice and dealings honestly? He is also going to ask us, did you believe in me? I gave you the obligation. I gave you the ability. Did you fulfill your obligation? And we're going to have to answer up to that.
it's not just, we can't sit back and say, well, you know what, God, I would have, but the person who tried to explain it to me didn't do a very good job, and that's why I don't. I just wasn't satisfied intellectually. No, belief in God is an obligation, just like the others. So that's another thing to keep in mind. It's for our own good. It's not something that I have to prove to you, or else you're free. Okay. Those are kind of just the opening points. So what are the proofs that have been offered over the years for the existence of God? And Mary Schiller, I just can't get over, he was 26 years old when he wrote this book. It's just mind-boggling. He cites, as I said, over 20 different proofs that have been offered by all kinds of people, scholars and philosophers. Some of the proofs are proofs that there is a supreme being. Some of the proofs are proofs that he is a benevolent God and which should lead to what he calls orthodox faith. That doesn't mean Judaism. That means orthodox faith. Other religions also have orthodox faith. They kind of believe in a supreme being who is kind and benevolent and has a purpose or a plan for the world. And then some of them are proofs for Torah Judaism or Torah reality. So we're going to present some of each. Okay? And it's amazing, a lot of these, again, now with our expanded definition of proof, a lot of these are just things that we feel inside. Kind of truths that we recognize ourselves. Maybe we didn't think about it, but hey, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty convincing. So proof number one, that there is a supreme being. How did it get here? How did it get here? How did the world get here?
Starship.
And that's really where Avraham started from, like Rambam said. That's called the cause, and each of these proofs has a fancy name. That's called the cosmological proof. For example, I'm going to read, like, you know, would you like to hear from Rabbi Ibn Pakuda, or would you like to hear from Thomas Aquinas? He's famous.
He was the first scholastic philosopher who learned a lot from Rambam and quotes Rambam often.
But he wasn't Jewish.
He was St. Thomas Aquinas.
Ah, that's it.
He was.
So wasn't Jewish for sure.
He started the Jesuits. In the middle 1200s.
Okay. Actually, he's dealing with the issue of, do we exist? Is existence real or is it imaginary? That's part of this proof. But basically what this proof is, he says, to attempt to prove the existence of God by pointing to the existence of the world has been one of the most popular ways in which metaphysicians of all faiths have sought to demonstrate the reality of a creator. In its simplest form, the cosmological argument is used by believers everywhere. Just stop to ask Mr. Average Believer why he adheres to the doctrine of a God who created the world, and he will invariably reply, well, somebody or something had to have gotten things started. In so replying, Mr. Average Believer has very neatly summed up the thoughts of literally thousands of theologians who have delved into this argument in depth. Once again, is that a proof that cannot be refuted? Or is it the simple faith approach? You know, you could say, no, nobody had to have gotten things started. Maybe it just happened. Okay, you could say that. You can't prove this. But what appeals to common faith? What appeals to common reason? That's what is the idea behind a proof. Just put it all into your database, make a basket filled with these kinds of evidence, and see what appeals to your reason. Okay, that's reason number one, and that's the most general type of proof All it proves is that there was a cause, that there was a causer. The teleological proof is a proof that one gets when he considers, and we're not doing 20, by the way, when he considers the design and the planning of the infinitely intelligent and merciful Creator, where he implanted intricate systems of digestion, circulation, respiration, the senses, reproductive ability within the human species and animal species, kind of like the argument that we heard once from that great old rabbi in Bnei Brak. That is famous with the apples. That was Rabbi Avigdor Miller. Then there was another Rabbi Lefkowitz, may he live and be well, who said, just look at the way that the body takes a piece of bread and breaks it up into its nutrients and its fats. And that's what Rabbi Schiller calls teleological proof. It doesn't prove anything about Judaism, but it proves a little bit more than that there was a cause. It proves that there is somebody very smart and very wise and very kind and good to have created such a sophisticated and such a benevolent type of organism like ourselves. Again, does it prove anything? I don't know, but it's pretty good evidence. Not only does God exist, but he's pretty smart and he's pretty good. A lot of the proofs, as I mentioned, are things that are feelings that people have. So let's go through these kind of quickly. Order. A feeling that things are in some way the way they should be. Ordinary, everyday awareness of the human soul. Trust, reliability, orderliness of existence. A mother comforts her scared child. What does she say to the child? Don't worry, it's going to be all right. How does she know it's going to be all right? Really? If the world has no cause, if the world has no leader, if the world has no creator, how does she know it's going to be all right? Is she lying to her child just to get the child to stop? Or does she really know inside of her that things are going to be all right? Is that a proof that there's a God? Maybe not a proof, but did you think about that? That's pretty convincing that we think there's an order because there is an order.
Things change. What about that? I mean, it's not going to stay just like...
That's a good question. That's a question. But does that, therefore, what does that question suggest? In other words, that doesn't dismantle the proof. In other words, I'm not saying we know the answers to everything. But think about it. There is a certain reliability, a certain trust that we have within us. And don't forget, we have a soul, and the soul senses the truth of the Creator. Just as there is an internal feeling of order, there is also reliability in the natural world outside of us. Do we know that the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning? I think we do. We trust a lot of things in the world around us. Everyone trusts the world, and therefore, however unknowingly, trusts God. That was a quote from a secular philosopher. There are other senses of order. First of all, there is the reality of self. I realize that I exist. However, we have overlooked one basic feeling, which is in reality the only starting point for any discussion of man. Man fervently believes himself to be. I exist. Is there any basis for this feeling other than the assumption of an eternally true God who guarantees us the reality of our existence? Not only do I exist now, but I know that I will continue to exist. You might ask the question, well, then why do we die? That's a good question. But that doesn't deny the fact that we're living now and that we will continue to live until we die. Again, does it prove No. Does it convince? Ask yourself. How about the universal assent proof? It is transcultural. It is transhistorical. It's an intuition which has been held by every kind of society in every era. It is one of the most popular notions known to man, that there's a God. Is that not an indication of objective reality? If it was just some type of a lie or theory that some old man made up on some mountaintop, would it be so highly regarded? Almost all human beings from the dawn of time to the present day have believed in some form of deity. An inner. That's more like societal. Back to the feelings. There's a sense of dependence in something higher. You know, we all feel that although we have abilities, although we have strength, we feel dependent. We feel that we're not in control. We're not powerful. Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, you've probably heard of him. I believe there is a God because man is finite, weak, and frail, and he is always seeking strength and support from some source beyond himself. Friends, the family, the race, the state, nature itself. But none of these things is strong enough to satisfy man's desire for security. He longs for something which these cannot give. He may not admit it, but he yearns for a power stronger than man, stronger than the nation. He yearns for God. Just that human feeling of dependence, that is also a proof for God. Okay, it goes on and on. We don't have time for everything. There is a sense of dread that people have, also a natural feeling. They're afraid that something could happen. There seems to be this power out there that has the ability to do things that could be cataclysmic to us. He says that is the soul's yearning for Yiras Hashem, for the fear of God. We also have a hope. There's a certain sense of hope. Hope for the future. We work very hard to provide security for the next generation. We're willing to sacrifice ourselves. Work hard. Give things up. We're hoping for success. Moral success. Where do these drives come from? Why are we worrying about tomorrow? Why do we care if we're morally successful? Why do we care if we're a good person or a bad person? Again, it's the yearning. There's a truth. There's an inner truth which we recognize deep down inside of us. That didn't just come from nowhere. In fact, there's the punishment proof. We demand that perpetrators of grotesque evil be punished. Why? If the world is secular and there is no morality and there's no higher power that says that people have to act a certain way, why do we get incensed when somebody is evil? Why should we feel that way? Why do people feel guilty about bad things that they've done? There's something inside of us that tells us. It's something inborn. We didn't learn it. We feel, this is called the home but not home proof. Yearnings, longings which we cannot adequately satisfy. They seem to indicate that man exists for some purpose beyond the purely secular. Again, it's not a proof, but it guides us. It points us in the right direction. Okay. So, many of these proofs point to the fact that there is a supreme being, and that this supreme being has a truth, there's a morality, there's an order, there is a direction, there is a striving for something higher than just the here and now. And finally, we get to the area of proofs for Torah. Because when it comes down to it, a Jew has to not just be a deist, not just believe in God, even in a compassionate God or a moral God. The calling of a Jew, the obligation that we said before that a Jew has to is believe the God of Israel, the God of the Torah, and the Torah of the God. That is really our obligation. And how can we prove that for ourselves? How can that appeal to our sense of reason and our sense of simple understanding? So there are many such proofs as well. The whole concept of the revelation at Sinai, the whole notion that Judaism was presented in front of millions of men, women, and children. And it was something that we had witnesses to. And it is something that people have told the story year after year, generation after generation, in all different countries. And you know what? You know when the first time anybody started to question that story? Anybody. Nobody ever questioned that story. You know when the first time that story was questioned? Our author's historical research says about 200 years ago when the Enlightenment came out and it spilled over to the Jewish community and there were Jewish Enlightenists and they said, that never happened. That's a legend. That's only the last 200 years. For thousands of years, nobody ever questioned the veracity of that story because it was history just like we accept the history of Europe. You know, even if you and I have never traveled to Europe, we know there's a Europe because it's in our history book. He writes a beautiful thing. We have in our possession, Judaism, all the prerequisites necessary to establish its reliability according to the demands of the science of history. We have documents, we have testimony, we have continuous link. We lived in the land of Israel for 1,380 years after Sinai, not with an interruption between 70 years. We're living in the same places that all the Bible talks about. We knew exactly where those places were. We knew where Abraham lived. We knew where the Akedah occurred. We knew where this prophet was buried. We used to visit their sites. We saw Egypt. We saw the pyramids. This was living to this. It wasn't just some storybook. For 1,000 years, how many years since then? Only less than 2,000 years. And we even after that ran out, we have archaeology that supports it. So we've got as much evidence as any historical system would require. Okay, and there's many other things. That's the main one. But we also have religious experiences. We also have saints throughout the history that have actually performed miracles that show that they are somehow connected with this supreme Jewish God. And we have the fulfillment of prophecies that the Bible gives. There was a great presentation this past Tisha B'Av where the Gateways Seminar documents 21 prophecies in the Tanakh, right? And then shows historical that every single one has been fulfilled, except for two, because they haven't happened yet. Yeah. The coming of the Mashiach and the resurrection of the dead. Everything else that the Bible said was going to happen, happened. Prophecies have been fulfilled. You can just look at the Torah and study the Torah and see the continuity, the consistency. Unlike other Bibles, which have been shown to have gross inconsistencies, we see the beauty, we see the depth. And don't think that the Jewish people have been this gullible bunch to believe anything, because we are the most argumentative, the most stubborn of any society. And still, these are truths that we all hold. Until recently, when we started getting all of this skepticism. What's our conclusion and what's our surprise ending? Our surprise ending is that we came here to prove God. But if we have so many proofs of God, how come there are so many people that don't believe in God? How come there were so many people in the times of Abraham that chose idolatry over monotheism? How come today, with all of this simple, straightforward thinking, those that believe in God and those that believe in Torah, and even those Jews that believe in Torah, can be counted on a very small scale? What happened to all the proofs of God? The conclusion is that goes back to our two main characters. Our conclusion is that faith in God is more a matter of man than it is of God. What it takes to have faith in God is a man. Is an Abraham. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to, we could accept God on the basis of any one of these proofs. That's not the issue. The issue is, are we willing to think, to question, to look for truth, and to take on the world, even if the entire world thinks otherwise? I'm not interested in what the world thinks. I'm interested in what the truth is. That is the key to belief in God. It's man. Remember our analogy last week. When you see two characters, there's Dick and there's Jane, it's easy to see who is Dick and easy to see who is Jane. But our two characters, God and man, is it God or is it man? Does God have to prove himself? No. There's ample proof for God. He's everywhere. He's outside, he's inside, he's everywhere. Wherever we let him in. It's about man. And that is why we need Abraham. We need Abraham even if we have a Moshe. Because that's going to be a constant in every generation in Judaism, no matter what the Besorah is, no matter what the teaching is, the tradition, no matter how many sources we have, no matter how many proofs we have, if the man is not going to say, I'm going to look for truth, and I'm going to find it, it ain't going to happen. I understand now, better than ever, what Rabbi Luzzatto wrote in Mesilas Yesharim in the introduction. Not in the introduction, in chapter 1. The bedrock of piety and the root of flawless divine service lies in man's effort to clarify and verify what his duty is in his world. He must determine what he is aiming for and how to achieve this in all his labors throughout his lifetime. That's it. That's what it all depends on. Is man going to ask the question? Is man going to think about it? Is man going to think? And I want to apologize because we also had a class once when I asked you, what is the most important thing that we need for Judaism to be perpetuated? I asked that. We went around the table and somebody said a sitter, somebody said a chumash. The conclusion in that class was we need a Torah scholar. We need someone to be the source for our tradition. And that was the conclusion of the class. We need to have a source for tradition. Now, I'm not sure that's enough. I think that the real answer is, maybe hand in hand with, but maybe even primary. We need a man to think and to look for the truth. That is the most important necessary ingredient for the perpetuation of Judaism. In other words, Abraham. If we have Abraham, now, it may be that we need both. It could be that today we don't have someone that's going to search for the truth and find it without a Masorah, without a tradition. We need the Torah. But just having a Torah with nobody to be determined to discover it and to learn it and to accept it, it's not going to help us have faith. So the most important thing that we need is Abraham, or a searching, truth-searching man. So that's our surprise ending. We came here, we thought, to learn all about God and to prove God. And we realized at the end that depends on man. Next week, Mirtz Hashem, I would like to just explore with you to get to know that man a little bit better. What are we made of? What is our capacity to search and to transform? I think that Parshas Vayera provides a great arena for that, because you have Abraham and Yitzchak being willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for the sake of their relationship with God. The ultimate. Abraham undergoes many tests. He's driven to become, to transform, to become that ultimate connector. Remember last week, God and man connecting. Abraham and Yitzchak demonstrate the ultimate connecting of man to God. And I think that will be our quest for next week. We have ample, Baruch Hashem, thank you Rabbi Schiller, we have ample evidence, if you will, that there is a God. But I think that we've also come to see that even God depends on the man that's searching for him. Thank you.
Yes, Nicole, but it's not basic.
This is basic.
Not easy.
This is, well,
and it's philosophy 101 or 102, and it's very tough.
It's tough to understand, or it's tough to... Please, at any time, if you think that what I'm telling you is not basic, I want to strike it from your curriculum. Really, I'm not trying to be difficult.
No, but we're trying basic. To be hard to prove. Absence of proof is not proof of absence. Right? And this is not mathematical science. And so why
right.
are we trying so hard to prove something beyond it? A shadow without, beyond any scintilla. The absence of proof, the lack of absolute proof, proves nothing.
Okay. You want to hear something? I skipped one of the best proofs of all. And that's
so
what
hard?
You just said. The one of the best proofs was stated, it was Mamish at the end, and I wanted to speed things up. But the existentialist proof was stated by Kierkegaard. Did I pronounce that right? For to prove the existence of one who is present is the most shameless effort, since it is an attempt to make him ridiculous. How could it occur to anybody to prove that he exists unless one had permitted oneself to ignore him? And now makes the thing all the more by proving his existence before his very nose. Kierkegaard said, you don't have to prove God. Okay, beautiful. That's enough for you. That may be enough for everyone. But the fact of the matter is, that depended on your willingness to accept it. That's the point. The point is that proofs of God are really only meaningful for somebody that needs them to help them accept.
Yeah,
it doesn't
for people
make
who know
them accept
and believe,
it.
No explanation is necessary.
That's correct.
And for those who don't,
although,
none will ever suffice.
Although I got strength from this, because I hear other people talking, and I am aware of questions or skepticism that is out there, and when I hear answers to that, it's not that I was going to chuck it, but it strengthens me to know that there is a lot of wisdom. But again, what it ultimately depends on is each person. Each person to the degree that they are willing to search for truth and accept it. That's really the source of truth, of faith in God.
You said it
Thank
last
you.
Week when you said that we really don't know anything. You said that. We really don't know anything. And I would object to the word truth. I don't think we can ever know truth. Truth is not anything that you could know. And if truth was there, how would you know it's true?
Okay.
It's just, it's all faith. And that's good. You should have faith. And you should believe. but to try and prove.
I don't agree with that.
You
there
know
are
the
some
truth.
Things that you know a priori.
You know,
you know them intuitively. You know them because you feel them to the
because
depth of your soul.
Because you feel them.
No, no. Because
do
you
know
it.
Anything?
You know it. You know it. It's more than feeling it. You know it.
You know it?
You know it intuitively.
You
know it. It's like what Rabbi Goldberg said one time, I think, stuck with me, which is, I don't know if it was his argument or somebody else's, that if you see life as an illusion, and it really is an illusion,
yeah.
Life we can't trust.
Yeah.
This case we can't trust. It may or may not be here. But the notion of God and the Torah, that sort of truth is reliable truth. That is truth. That's a truth that you can know. You don't have to touch it to know it. You just can know it.
Well, I can't buy that. I don't think you can know anything. You can't know it, and because even if you knew it, you don't know it's true.
You're right, and you're right. You know why?
Because we're both right.
No. Because this is a matter of a person's own acceptance. You believe what you believe. You believe what you believe. And you're both right.
Well, that's a good rabbinical comment.
It's the reality. This is your reality. This is your reality. Now, let's remember that God, and this is where God meets man. God is something perfect, objective. Man is this imperfect, doubting, skeptical being. Man, God put these truths out there, and it's up to man to accept them. God says, you are obligated to believe in me, and now the rest is up to man. It's up to man to do that on his own.
It's like love or beauty. I mean, can you prove beauty, or do you know it when you see it?
One can't prove something further. But one has to grapple.
I believe in beauty, and I believe...
You're next.
My father used to say, did God invent man, or did man invent God? And you brought that up.
Good question. In a certain sense, in actuality, God invented man. But it takes a man to discover God.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. It does. Wendy.
Well, that's my understanding that lech lecha is actually that about going, when it says go, it means to go within. And to find
go into
and
you.
Other, right.
Lech lecha.
Right.
Interesting. Go to you.
That's right. And to go in here. And the answers are in here. And with what you said, that he created us with all this information.
Mm-hmm.
And created our wisdom and knowledge within us about his existence.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get into the Ramchal in his book, The Knowing Heart,
mm-hmm.
that takes us to another place that we know these truths within ourselves. And for the person that we say is not a believer, I don't know necessarily that a person does not believe in God. I often wonder if it's a matter that we feel like we're going to do it our way, and we're going to pull it through, and there's no repercussions,
mm-hmm.
and we think we can get away with it, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
without having to answer to a higher power,
mm-hmm.
Who is really in control of everything. We think, you know, there are times that we can take this control, and it's going to happen the way we want it to happen, and what does it say about making an angel and God laugh, just tell them a plan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The other thing I find objectionable is if you got a proof, one is enough. You have a proof, it proves it. Okay, all the rest is unnecessary. You give a proof and say, oh, we're going to give you another proof. Why? The other one was not satisfactory? I'm going to give you yet another one. Why?
It's only if you need it.
Only if you need it. In other words, you got a proof, it's a proof. But I don't know if this...
You might not need it.
Not in
do
a
we
court
exist
of law.
Is there reality?
In a legal sense, proof is the preponderance of evidence, isn't it?
That's the preponderance of evidence.
Well, that's the proof.
That's the
you
preponderance
advance an argument
of evidence.
And it either proves your point or doesn't prove your point on the basis of the evidence you submit.
No, that's the difference between civil law and criminal law. You know, you can prove, you know, with beyond a reasonable doubt, But there's a doubt.
There still can be a doubt.
So let me ask you all the question. Help me understand. How many people that you know that would call themselves non-believers would be different if they would learn about these proofs? Do you think it would make a difference?
No.
But I see when you said proofs, what I immediately thought of
were the 10 trials of Abraham and Moses, which came to 20. When a man hears and sees what a man has to go through to achieve something, that he is striving to something that's much more than just the Torah, it tells him something. God has had to have been present for Moses and Abraham to get through all of those trials. I think that's the significance. That's the striving. But your point that you said in the beginning was really insightful, that Moses, Abraham had been doing this for many, many years before God chose him to become the father of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. That's that, why he that chose him, because he had been doing
that. His personality was such that he was very unique within his generation. But I don't think, I agree, I don't think knowing these proofs will change your opinion. And you use the Jewish expression, the simple truth. The people I know who are secularly educated and not into this would not accept the simple truth. They would not. They would fight you with tooth and nail.
Which goes to show that these are not, that you can't prove it, which goes to show that it really boils down to the man. It really boils down to the man. If you're going to be an Abraham, you'll accept it. If not, you won't.
God, you said at the end, God needs us to do what? He doesn't need anything, God.
No.
Well, he needs us to reach for
in order for us, in order for us to fulfill, in order, God had a purpose. God's purpose, just basic, God's purpose was to create a world and bring goodness to those who created.
Yeah.
That was his purpose. And he made that goodness conditional upon our joining him in the play. I'm not going to give you goodness as a unilateral bestowing. I am going to give you goodness by you joining me in the process and earning that goodness. So he needs us to play our part in order for his purpose to be realized. That's what it means. He needs us. He needs us to bring his purpose of his creation of us to fruition.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, the teacher says to the class, I need you to do your work. No, the teacher doesn't really need the student to do the work. The teacher doesn't even have to be a teacher. The teacher is saying, I need you to do your work so that we can be, so that we can make you educated. I can't do it for you. I can't do your work for you. You have to do your work. I need you to do your work.
The word may be require.
Really, relationship. Mm-hmm. It has to do more with relationship. So the fact that we have God in our lives, it gives us relationship. That
comes about because of the fact that God is good. Because he's good, and this was last week's class, because the basic, the most basic attribute of God is that he's good, that invites a relationship. If God was, let's say, not good, if God was just, and that was his primary characteristic, that would not necessarily invite a relationship. That would invite a master servant, which is not what we would call a relationship. What invites a relationship of love and closeness is the fact that God's primary attribute is goodness and chesed. We have to learn that too. We have to learn that that is the primary aspect of God. Last week,
I don't understand what good is sometimes. Because if you think of the Holocaust,
right.
Always when I hear a lecture on the Holocaust, it always says to me,
"That's like,
you know,
well, hardest
that's
thing."
That's a whole thing to, because God has a plan. Rabbi Akiva and all the others who we read about at Yom Kippur, who all had this terror, he has a plan that was supposed to be.
The ultimate is goodness. Yes.
But it always goes back to the question, how did God let this happen? Why did God let...
You know what? That's not basic.
I'm planting a seed in the earth is, and when we do that, and we think that we're responsible for all the processes that that thing is going to go through to provide something for us, and we forget everything else oftentimes, and we, again, that we think it's us, and we forget that this power so far greater than us is allowing that to happen.
To me, it just seems that until the Enlightenment in the mid
1800s, 1700s,
that with living in a enclosed environment, people were very knowledgeable. People could question, but they questioned with already having a formation of God in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Once we had Enlightenment and people moving out mm-hmm. away from community, and people being educated by secular scholars in the world, philosophy, whatever, which I think is good, but that takes away
mm-hmm.
having basic knowledge. I think the problem with Judaism today is that there is no basic
mm-hmm.
knowledge for people to want to get closer to God.
Isn't it sad?
Yeah. And to me, the fault is the conservative movements last 60 years of education in America, when there was no treatment of Jewish education as a real study, about holidays and things like that. And we the United States did it to ourselves.
My understanding, by the way, is that the conservatives, as denoted in the word conservative, was to conserve the lost Judaism, which was started in the early 1800s by the reformers, who almost eliminated any Jewish belief at all. And they were trying to conserve it, but they went halfway.
But there was, that's right, there was no teaching of Judaism.
Okay, but whose fault was that? It's sad. The point is that is the first two chapters of his book, is just, where are we and how did we get here? And let's realize what we're up against. And how few Avrahams there are in the world. Really? You think Lech Lecha is a story of ancient history? Lech Lecha is the story of today.
It's a shame.
Is this the book that Rabbi Rosenbaum, you got from his book thing? You went up there and you found that book?
That was Pathways.
That was
Pathways by Rabbi Wolbe. And Rabbi Wolbe, who was, in the yeshiva world, is like respected as the Musar authority, learned by Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz. He said that everyone has to read this book, The Road Back, which was written by a 26-year-old kid. And Rabbi Wolbe says he's telling it like it is. I didn't even know this history. Meir Schiller. He is a Feldheim. I think it's out of print. But he grew up in Brooklyn to a non-observant family. And he's very, very smart and inquisitive. He was an Avraham. And he says, I've got to find the truth. And the reason why he knows so much about all these sources is because these were the findings that he found by searching. He was 26 years old when he wrote this.
Unbelievable. More of an optimist. Wow. Anyway,
he talks about optimism, by the way. He says optimism is like secular optimism or optimistic humanism is when you say there's not really a God who controls things, but I'm going
to
be optimistic. I'm just going to hope that good things happen.
Yeah.
He says if you try to be an optimist, it's hard to be an optimist. It's easier. If you don't have God, you'll probably turn into a pessimist. Because there's really no reason to have... Why should we think it's going to be good?
Great job.